Sometimes in life, we are presented with once-in-a-lifetime opportunities that can change the trajectory of our future. In the case of Zeb Nowotzki, a 2 a.m. coffee run would lead to an interaction that would alter his world forever.
As luck would have it, I had a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, which I didn't know was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I was working for a guy who owned a restaurant. The restaurant was Sushi Samba, and I had just helped him open the last Sushi Samba in New York on Park Avenue South. And he said to me, I'm going to go buy Sound Factory. I said, wow. I said, I want to work on that, you know, get me in. He's like, I need you to go make friends with this guy, and whatever he tells you to do, you do it. And he had a partner, and his partner owned a nightclub, I think on 19th Street. And I remember waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning to bring security coffee. And mind you, I'm not a kid at this point. I'm probably 24 or 25 years old. But I sensed something with these guys, and I knew I needed to be in. And I actually have goosebumps talking about it, because I remember walking up to this nightclub middle of the morning, and people were spilling out, and I brought coffee for the security. And then I got called into his office, and I met a guy who changed my life.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss how to pivot your career to making it a passion, moving the ball forward with persistence, and a New York state of mind. And now, episode 21 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainer, the business leader, and the entrepreneur, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we speak with the pop culture anthropologist, Zeb Nowotzki. Zeb is a marketing expert and cultural forecaster specializing in experiential strategies that fuse the worlds of live, digital, technology, and multimedia into one cohesive brand platform or experience. He originally hails from New York, but currently lives in Los Angeles with his wife Jennifer and two daughters, Belle and Hazel. His agency, Enter, is at the forefront of this rapidly growing industry, with everyone from blue-chip brands like AT&T and InBev to emerging startups like Perfect Day and HaHa Tequila. He can be found most days working inside his coffee shop on Melrose Ave called, you guessed it, Agency Coffee Co. If they ever make a movie about his life, he would have to be played by Jonah Hill. With that being said, I'd like to welcome my good friend all the way from L.A., Zeb Nowotzki, to the podcast. Zeb, man, appreciate you coming on today.
From New York, live in L.A. You have to get that right.
So for people that may not be familiar with you, kind of who you are, your background, just kind of give a little, you know, quick little intro.
Where do I begin?
It's a lot going on, man. You got to tell me.
As far back as I can remember. I always wanted to be a gangster. just a different kind. I mean, professionally speaking, this is probably such a common anecdote for guys my age. I remember collecting and trading and selling baseball cards and sports memorabilia like it was religion.
Okay.
And it planted a seed in me that really showed me a lot about people and commerce. And I think when you learn those things at such a young age, I mean, I'm saying, like, you know, probably 10 years old, you know, wondering, you know, how to trade a Mickey Mantle rookie card and reading price guides and memorizing prices of cards and you know, what was going to go up and what was going to go down. And I became an analyst for this world of sports cards. And I was obsessed. I mean, there's no better way to describe it. And I think, you know, in talking about it now, that analytical approach really helped me later on in my career, because I consider myself a pop cultural anthropologist, and I really believe that I have an ability to study and interpret culture in a very unique way. My media diet is unparalleled as far as I'm concerned, and I'm an analyst. I'm still an analyst. I'm analyzing every day, and I'm looking for little wrinkles and little opportunities in culture that I can leverage for on behalf of brands, and that's become my career. And as a marketer and an experiential marketer, I think you have to be really good at that in 2019. I think you have to have a sense of you know, what's driving culture and what's driving consumers, and I think I can probably trace it back to collecting baseball cards. And I know that there's a whole generation of kids today that are going to be able to say the same exact thing in 20 years when it comes to sneakers. And I think that's so exciting, because it's a very similar skill set, and it's the same dynamic in terms of collecting, and you know, now it's, there's a lot more platforms dedicated to it, and you know, the StockX's of the world. But for me, you know, it resonates that way, and I see the same thing. And you know, ironically, Gary Vee was posting the other day that he thinks sports cards are coming back, and they represent a valuable investment, and probably more so than sneakers. And I honestly don't disagree, because as an aside, I think the sneaker market is incredibly diluted, and
it's definitely getting there,
mature. And I think, you know, the irony of that, especially coming from someone as prominent as him, was not lost on me.
Did you see the documentary though recently on Netflix about the trading cards?
I did.
What did you think? Because the way that looks doesn't make it seem like it's going to be a promising thing that's going to come back. However, this is why you're in this world. You're forecasting.
Yeah, I mean, look, it definitely had a bit of nostalgia. I think the human quotient of that story was, you know, somewhat bizarre.
Yeah.
But I remember those days. I remember, you know, the 1992 Topps Bryan Taylor rookie card, and you know, it was worth $100.
Yeah.
So, you know, it created a frenzy, and the frenzy was probably longer than it should have lasted. But if they would have been a little bit slower and steadier, there probably would have been some longevity, but they just pumped the market so much.
Yeah.
But I definitely think there's, you know, and not following it as closely as I do today, I do see some parallels, and the sports world specifically is very ripe for this. And I'll one up Gary Vee in terms of prognostication. The person who can figure out how to do trading cards for esports will actually, I just dropped like a crazy nugget. The person who can figure out how to do trading cards for esports players and teams will probably fuel the growth for that sector for the next, you know, 5 to 10 years.
I think that's actually a very interesting analyst kind of thought process, because, you know, I mean, look, they're building stadiums now for esports, arenas for esports. I don't even think the industry's even scratched the surface of what it's about today. Shout him out.
We need to talk.
So now, where did you grow up?
So I grew up on Long Island.
Okay.
In case you can't hear my accent.
Nice. Yankees or Mets?
I'm a Mets fan.
Okay.
Die hard.
Okay.
I would say, as I mentioned earlier, I'm from New York. I live in LA. I have turned my back on the Giants, on the Knicks, but I will never turn my back on the Mets.
Okay. All right.
I'm a Lakers fan. I'm a Rams fan. I feel like I'm okay in those.
I'm a Jets fan, so yeah. I can't really say shit right now.
Yeah, I mean, you never can say anything.
But every year, it's our year.
You know, I grew up idolizing 86 Mets and all those personalities.
Doc Gooden.
I mean, I could probably name the whole lineup. Some of those guys actually turned out to be pretty bad guys. Actually, probably too many of them, except for Gary Carter. But it's that generation of baseball and you know, those mid-80s Mets teams were probably my favorite. I found baseball harder to stay up to date on. So I think I end up gravitating towards football more because I can pay attention once a week.
Yeah.
And with my schedule and family and career, it's sort of like baseball is just very time consuming.
And how do you think New York kind of shaped you in your upbringing, your kind of how you became?
I mean, New York made me. You know, I was literally in New York yesterday. We were receiving an award from Adweek.
Shout out, plug it. And what was the award for?
Let the people know. Thank you for asking. Fastest growing experiential agency. And the reception was at the top of the Empire State Building. And I literally had that kind of, you know, euphoric moment where I'm like, I don't get here if I'm not, you know, built on the streets below and kind of sharpened by the streets below. And I think, you know, what I get or what I've gleaned from my years in New York is just an ambition and a hustle that I rarely see outside of that city. And that's why I still say I'm from New York and I live in LA, because I want people to know. As you know, when I first moved to LA, you know, I wake up at 4:45 in the morning and I'm on New York time and I feel like I'm running circles around my peers, because I'm wired, and I don't know any other way. I truly don't know another way to operate. Like the thought of like waking up at 9 a.m. and like going to yoga and like, you know, having a meeting and then going for lunch. I don't understand. Like, I'm New Yorkers by practice, I think, are, you know, brought into this hustle mindset of just go, 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 more, 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 more. And for me, it's something that I hold on to dearly. You know, every once in a while, I'll joke that I'm kind of getting soft. I had my golf clubs stolen a few months back.
That's rough life.
Yeah, I mean, I actually said, I was like, that shit would not have happened if I was still living in New York. So maybe my guard is down a little bit, but I do think it's probably the most formative thing for me. That being said, I love Los Angeles. I have, you know, my family, my wife, and my two kids. I think it provides a much different balance. And at this point in my career and this point in my personal life, I couldn't ask for more than what LA has provided. I mean, you know, you live in the city and you think a 350 square foot apartment is what you're supposed to live in.
Yeah, you're doing it.
Yeah, no, literally. You know, we moved, at one point we were living in Tribeca, and, you know, I had my car downstairs and I was like, oh, like we made it. And then I had a
parking
kid,
spot.
We had a kid, and I was like, we are not even close. And, you know, the city for me became more a place of what I can't do than a place of what I can do. And I think I found the alternative in California, and I love it there. And, you know, New York is great, 24 hours in, get that energy, and then leave.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of where I am right now. But it's definitely, you know, I think it's played a significant, if not defining role in terms of who I am.
Yeah, and I think that's important. The reason I always ask people kind of where they were raised and where they came from is I think that dictates a lot of their future successes or not successes in some matter. You know, in New York specifically, I think that hustle grind mentality is unparalleled. And I always laugh because people are always like, why are New Yorkers so rude or why are they assholes? And I'm like, they're actually not. They're just trying to get shit done. Like, they don't have time for the small talk bullshit.
No, and I went through a learning curve when I got out. You know, when I first started, when my thing started becoming national and I was moving and doing things more outside of New York, I would remember saying, like, what is wrong with these vendors in LA? And, like, why do I have to call this person 7 times? And why do I have to email them? And it's just like, if you email someone from New York, it's like, they're on it. It gets done. And you like email someone from LA, it's like maybe they get back to you, maybe they don't. And it's just that sense of urgency and kind of like head on a swivel mindset. I don't think you can really teach that outside of you know, that. And again, you know, for me, definitely feel that sense of like pride, but really happy with where I ended up and where my family is.
So you come up in New York, you get your entrepreneurial hat on at a young age, looking at baseball cards, analyzing, kind of getting submerged in pop culture, right? As you start to grow up, start to get a little older, what becomes the next kind of interest or the thing that starts to kind
amazing,
of shape you?
Amazing question. So that sort of gave me this foundation of like hustle, right? Like I'll trade you this for that. And like you have something I want and I'm going to do whatever I need to do to get it. And that sense of like acquiring. My next passion, I think, through high school and into college became nightlife. And I think I went from collecting baseball cards to collecting people. And I became a personality within the New York City nightlife landscape, which at the time, and maybe not as much anymore, but I think I have a different POV, was the best place in the world. And I started doing doors. And when you work the door of a nightclub, you know, and mind you, I'm a junior in college now, you're a gatekeeper, and you become a gatekeeper, and you have this control or power. And I was always so passionate about the history of nightlife and thinking about people like Ian Schrager and Peter Gation. And I became a student. I knew every club. I knew who the promoters were. And I just became obsessed with nightlife. Mind you, I'm a white Jewish kid from the suburbs of Long Island who's never tried a drug in his entire life. Not a really good dancer, but I saw nightlife as this backdrop for something. And as I got older, it started to really become clear to me that the what happens in a nightclub and in nightlife and hospitality in general is this amazing melting pot of culture. And I was able to start identifying trends and things within those pockets of culture and leveraging them for brands. So for me, you know, being a part of that backdrop and having access, truly, you know, probably the single greatest driver from a professional standpoint to me, even today. I can't go back to New York and not walk down the street and not see someone. I haven't lived in New York in 5 years. There's not a street that I could walk down in New York City and not have somebody stop me or see somebody that I was friends with when I lived there and I still keep in touch with. And I built this network, this giant network, pre-social media, of air quote friends. And when I say I was collecting people, I was so obsessed with, and this is like pre-socialite era, but I was so obsessed with who people were and what their stories were and how can I become friends with them. And I never wanted it from a self-aggrandizing place. I wanted to know everything, right? And consume all these stories and really digest them so that, you know, if one day I own my own nightclub, you know, or something like that, I would be able to host them and I would be a better owner. And as luck would have it, I had an once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, which I didn't know was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I was working for a guy who owned a restaurant. The restaurant was Sushi Samba. And I had just helped him open the last Sushi Samba in New York on Park Avenue South. And he said to me, I'm going to go buy Sound Factory. I said, wow.
Yeah, that's you big
know,
play.
Yeah. I said, I want to work on that, you know. Get me in. He's like, I need you to go make friends with this guy. And whatever he tells you to do, you do it. And he had a partner. And his partner owned a nightclub, I think on 19th Street. And I remember waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning to bring security coffee. And mind you, I'm not a kid at this point. I'm probably 24 or 25 years old. But I sensed something with these guys, and I knew that I needed to be in. And I actually have goosebumps talking about it because I remember walking up to this nightclub middle of the morning and people are spilling out, and I brought coffee for the security. And then I got called into his office. and I met a guy who changed my life. His name is Eddie Dean, and he ended up orchestrating a deal to bring Pacha from Ibiza.
Very famous nightclub, probably, for those that don't know. Yeah. One of the famous.
I would say probably the most famous nightclub in the world. And he brought it to New York. And he turned this building on 46th Street into a mecca and put me out front and let me be one of the faces of the club and let me be his partner. And it changed my life. And it put me at the pinnacle of nightlife in a very quick amount of time.
So the one thing that I always kind of love hearing people talk throughout their story, and I look for key words, right? Or things that they say that kind of dictates who they are character-wise. There's a couple things that you've said that I find fascinating. One is, whether it was talking about the baseball cards or talking about the nightlife component, the word obsessed. I think that's a huge kind of factor in what plays into all this. It's not an interest. It's not I liked. You literally become consumed in it. And you also said I become a student. And I think that's the thing that a lot of younger entrepreneurials, millennials, influencers, whatever you want to call it, they're not understanding about how much time behind the scenes is going into and invested into learning a subject matter. You know, to study baseball cards and price guides is not a quick thing. Like, you really have to analyze it. Hundreds of cards, hundreds of players, hundreds of positions, values are constantly changing. And then on the nightlife scene, thousands of people, different personalities, different ways they operate, who they are, what they do. But the more shit that seems to be involved, the greater you take an interest in it. So the more complexity, the more rewarding for you. When I think most people are looking for more comfort and shit that doesn't take as much time or energy. So for me, it's interesting that you find currency in the value of education and investment versus just the status of it all.
For sure. And I mean, look, I actually still have goosebumps thinking about waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning to bring a security guard's coffee. And I think that hustle represents me in so many levels, because I would do whatever it takes. And if I wanted something, I would just, there's nothing that could stop me from pursuing that goal. And you don't see a lot of that today, but when you do, you know it instantaneously.
How often do you think people miss their opportunity in life because of the fact that they didn't do the little shit like this?
I'm bewildered today, and I don't want to sound negative, but for me, it's truly, you know, I think there's a generation of people that there's a level of entitlement that is far different than what I grew up with. And for me, I think it makes it easier when you find someone that can be that five-tool player, that can be a jack-of-all-trades, that can be truly, you know, versatile to our organization. That's instantly something that I'm drawn to, and we know that they're a keeper. And a lot of it, I think, can be, you know, traced back to the hospitality industry, if I had to kind of draw a parallel. Really tough industry, right? You know, I think what you learn in that business sets you up for client services. And if you're good, you can do it at a high level. And, you know, I love people that have worked in hospitality, whether it's at a hotel or a restaurant or a lounge, because they know how to deal with people. And, like, so much of business and just commerce is being intuitive enough to understand that. And I think, you know, like, you don't really learn that in business school.
No.
With all due respect to the MBAs out there. But if you were 3 years as a cocktail waitress, or you know, worked 3 years doing the door at a hotel or at a nightclub, you get it. Like, you can feel people and you can feel their energy. And if I can parlay that into my industry and my business and marketing world, those are keepers for me. And I really always find myself gravitating towards, when I look at resumes, you know, where do they work? And I think it's a skill set that's so valuable and so underestimated in just today's world.
So most people invest into stocks and other things. You invest into people.
For sure.
So now,
I mean, I hate to go back to my man, Gary Vee. What up, Gary Vee? But he has a quote you work for them. You know, and I truly feel...
Real talk.
Yeah, I truly feel like I work for my team and I need to be there for them. And, you know, the days of a boss, you know, who doesn't understand that and who can't show empathy are, like, short and few and far between. Because yeah. I think there's an entire generation of people who are far more, have far higher emotional quotients and need more from their careers. And what I've done with Enter is leaned into that. And I've made sure that I can support that and embrace their will to travel, or, you know, somebody wants to go surfing on Friday or do yoga on Monday afternoon. It's like, well, is your work done? Do you have any calls? Don't let me stand in your way, because I know that having that balance is crucial to success and motivates them. And yeah. I think by providing that and creating a workplace dynamic that supports that and embraces that, you don't see turnover. And I don't really have turnover. I mean, you know, the thought of, you know, having to, I have growth that, you know, that excites me, but we don't really ever have to replace people because they stay with me. And there's a loyalty that I think is developed by virtue of that. And you don't get that working at sitting at a cubicle.
No. And I think, you know, leaders and business owners are going to have to start adopting this model. And I'm a big, big believer and advocate of this forefront. And I say this all the time, and I tell our team this all the time. You're investing into my dream, into my vision. So the least I can do is invest into you, to your family, to your balance of life. And they're happier, they perform better, they execute better. Just because you're a 9-to-5 doesn't mean that you have to fill every single second just to fill it. So I think the fact that, A, less turnover for you means less expenses at the end of the day. They take pride in what they do, they deliver better work, and they're truly committed.
For sure.
I mean, is hence why you've seen the success that you've seen. So now I want to take it back. So now you get this opportunity to work the door at pretty much the biggest club coming to the U.S. at this point, and you look at this and go, I'm going to jump all over it, right? Yeah. Most people, they may talk themselves out of it. Well, am I ready? And this, if you stay ready, you don't need to get ready, is the way I look at it.
And first of all, I was the director of VIP services.
Oh, shit. So okay. I want to get it right.
Yeah. Okay. And I was a partner, but.
Well, the partner part, why? That is interesting. So that they made you a partner at a very young age.
I bet on myself and I risked everything I had. I actually left law school.
Oh, so you were in law school at this
I was
point.
In law school for a year.
And you went to, where'd you go to school?
Cardozo Law School.
Okay.
I dropped out of law school to open a nightclub, which is probably one of the craziest things I've ever said out loud.
So how did your family feel about that?
My mother was so disappointed. I think my father was more confused because I just don't think he understood what I wanted to do. But I knew... I mean, look, again, like the stereotypes, right? Like, I went to an Ivy League university and I'm supposed to be, you know, this high-powered attorney. And, you know, I just spend all this money on Cornell and you're telling me you want to, you know, work in a nightclub? And I mean, look, that was a huge leap. I mean, fearless leap. Right.
But did you look at it as a risk, or did you know within your gut that this was what needed to be done?
I knew that I was really passionate about nightlife. I knew that I didn't want to do nightlife my entire life, but I also knew that I believed in these guys and I believed in what they were doing and I believed in the timing, and I just sensed an opportunity. And this is a very common thread in my entire life where I felt something and saw something that was going to be big, and I knew that I had to be a part of it. And if I wanted to change the narrative of Zev Narotsky, this, you know, impresario nightlife guy who's like, you know, runs around the city in the Hamptons, I needed something bigger than other people's places. And they gave me this platform, and it was, you know, perfect timing for music and for the type of music that people wanted to listen to. You know, I remember the Friday before we opened. I remember the opening lineup. Thursday night, we did a private PR reception with Little Louis Vega because we wanted the credibility, that New York sound. Friday night, we did Steve Angelo, pre-Swedish House Mafia explosion. And then Saturday was Eric Murillo. And we were shut down on Saturday night. Cops turned the lights off. And that began this roller coaster of, you know, being an ambassador for the world's biggest nightclub brand and traveling around the country and doing events in Ibiza and Miami and Las Vegas. And it was my MBA. So if anyone ever asks, you know, I launched a globally renowned brand in the biggest city in the world with no roadmap. And it's something I'm extremely proud of. And fortunately for me, it also represented the next chapter in my career because I had felt that I could never do anything more in nightlife than this brand. I truly felt like, where do you go from here?
Pinnacle, yeah.
And by way of what we had built, we were approached by an agency, and I didn't know what agencies were at the time, but an agency knocked on the door and they said, we work for Pepsi. We want to launch an energy drink. Can you help us? And at the time, Pasha was the largest account for Red Bull on the planet. And we said, sure. What can we do? And they called me in because I understood, here's what a table should look like, and here's how people engage with a bottle service table, and here's what the waitresses need, and I was a one-man focus group, and I could literally tell this agency, here's how you guys are going to break into on-premise. And I didn't know that I was good at this yet, and I didn't understand the connection, but it felt very rewarding because here are these like suits from Pepsi who are coming to me for information and strategy and insights that they can't get themselves. So I started to realize, like, I'm pretty valuable here in the right context. And this is exciting because now I can set my eyes on corporate America and what does that look like. So I had a new obsession. And as luck would have it, that agency ended up offering me a job and a career. And I knew that nightlife wasn't a career, it was a passion. And I wanted that challenge. And
how do you divide, though, career and passion, right? Because a lot of people, I don't know if they know to separate the two or how they define it. They may get into something thinking this is my career, but they don't understand it's really a passion or vice versa.
For sure.
How did you define that line?
I think the scale of it, right? I think I knew that my earnings power was going to be limited in nightlife, right? I was only ever going to make X. But then I saw this other lane with marketing and agencies. And I was like, well, if I could be successful there, you know, there might be a much higher ceiling on what I can accomplish. And I think that was the challenge that I set internally. The irony of all of this is the parallels between what I was doing in those early days in a dark nightclub on 46th Street and today are not that far apart. It's still using the same cultural insights. It's still using the same network. And it's still using my, you know, really expert ability to market brands. I just get to do it on a much bigger level now than I was.
Different hours too.
Yeah, a little bit different hours. But, you know, for me, and I hate to use like the Gladwell 10,000 hours deal, but like I had 10,000 hours in marketing before I became a marketer. And you can't take that away from me. I mean, I was running events 3 nights a week. So, you know, when it came time to actually working for brands like Heineken and Jim Beam and Pepsi, it was the most natural evolution of my professional life that I could have ever anticipated. And I did not anticipate it. It's not something, you know, now you go to school for experiential marketing, right? I was again, a student of all of this without really knowing where it was going to take me. And I love the Steve Jobs quote. I think he was speaking at a university in California. He said, you know, you can't connect the dots looking forward, but you can connect them looking backwards. And at the time, I was really connecting all these dots in a very, very strategic way. And then when I went to work at this agency, you know, I still kind of had one foot in nightlife and hospitality, and I was working, you know, day and night. But I was sure, even then, and this is like, I think 2005, 2006, I was certain that I was going to dominate this industry. And I didn't know how, and I didn't know when. And I just had a confidence and a way about me that I think belied what I had done, you know, my whole life, which is analyze and just be like so observatory and so, you know, critical of everything that it gave me a confidence. And when I spoke, I had a POV, and I learned as a salesman how to translate that and work with brands and communicate culture and platforms back to them in a way that they would understand, and to a place where it's actually become my passion. And again, like, how do you draw the line?
Could passion be a career?
Yeah, I have said, and I will continue to say, I don't feel like I work. And some of the, you know, sometimes I get into a fight with my wife, and she's like, you're just doing too much. You're working too hard. And it's, I don't feel that. I truly don't feel that way. And like, for me, you know, being on a red eye, flying to another city, doing an event, flying back the same day, having a, you know, working out at 5 o'clock in the morning and then having a conference call at 8, like, I don't see that as working too hard. And for me, it doesn't feel like I'm overexerting myself, and it doesn't feel like I'm burning myself out. It just feels like that's the way I operate, and that's how I move.
Well, I mean, think about it, man. There's people that watch 10 hours of Netflix on a fucking Saturday or Sunday. You know, they're not really doing anything. They're watching Netflix. You're doing the same thing, just in a different capacity.
Yeah, just.
So here's the thing that I find interesting, right? We have a lot of people that I'll talk to, and some people are very map-driven, right? Like, here's my goal. Here's how I'm going to get there. Some people are just kind of take it as it comes. What's interesting is you're almost like a hybrid in the sense that you had some things that you mapped out, and then some things you just kind of went with the whim of it. Do you feel like being flexible was beneficial, but also having a plan at the same time?
Yeah. For me, the speed at which I make decisions is the most valuable asset that I have as a CEO.
And why is that?
I am instant. Like, if there's a question, if there's a problem, if anything needs my attention, my response is usually instantaneous. And I think that's not to say that I'm always right, because I'm probably wrong more often than not, but I have an ability to answer, and I don't get bogged down, and I don't get allow myself to be slowed down by lack of response. And it's fundamentally what makes me effective and what makes me so dialed in as the CEO, because it's just, here you go, here you go, here you go. And if I'm wrong, or if we need to make a pivot or call an audible, we will, but there's always an answer. And I think especially for my team, you're never not going to get an answer. And they understand that they're not going to get an answer. They're never not going to get an answer. And I think that's like trust factor and commitment to responding, I have not seen that in a lot of executives, and I've not seen that in a lot of places that I've worked in my career where there's someone that on and that committed to responding. And it's actually, I think you brought up CAA earlier, but my friend taught me that at CAA, they have an internal code with internal communication. And it's, you could have 100 emails on your desk. If one of them is from a colleague, you answer the one from your colleague first. And that's a core value within CAA. And I kind of really subscribe to that, because I think you know, it's what moves organizations, right? And it's sort of like getting really granular, but I have to respond, and I make sure that I respond, I make sure that I answer, and I do it quickly as possible. And I think, like, so crucial, right? Because so many people are just like dragging and delaying and reluctant, and I just know that I have an answer, and I believe in my answer, and I trust my instinct, and it's just something that I've gotten really super committed to, you know, just being, having that ability.
So, you know, one of the things is execution, right? And I think this is where a lot of people lack. Do you execute in all areas effectively? It sounds like, whether it be email, phone calls, activations, events, is that kind of what has separated you, is the fact that while most people are kind of thinking it through or dragging out or laying, like you're saying, you're already moving. And if it's a no, then you're pivoting. If it's a yes, great. And it's expediting this process.
I am a devout subscriber to the philosophy of failing forward. And ironically, you know, what one of the things that I learned at Pasha was this metaphor of moving the ball forward. And it's, you know, I love that notion of, like, just move the ball forward, you know? And I think, especially as it relates to our projects, and my team has heard me say this probably a million times, we have to move the ball forward. Because if you can't show forward progress, you're not executing. And the closer I can get them to the end zone, the more likely we are for success. What can happen so often, especially on experiential projects and things that are tied into bigger communications plans, above the line, below the line, is they stop, and things stop, and you really get mired down in bureaucracy of working with brands, working with other agencies. So for me, it's this constant pressure to move forward, and I'm a catalyst for that. Like, I personify that in every aspect of my life, because I know that the second I take my foot off the gas, they will see that and think that it's okay for them to take their foot off the gas when it's not. And as a leader, and as a, you know, an executive, I think you have to maintain that. And I think it's so hard to disguise it, because, again, there's a heightened sensitivity today. And, you know, you don't want to be the guy throwing shit against the wall and yelling. No one on my team has ever heard me yell, ever. And the slower and softer I speak, the more excited I am. And they actually understand that. And it's all intentional, because I know that when Rome is fucking on fire, I have to be the voice of reason and lead by example. And I have a lot of experience putting out fires, and it's just become the norm for me. I mean, it's truly become the norm for me, where I'm so comfortable in that situation. A lot of people in marketing and experiential by default are not prepared for the pressure that comes with this career and with these events. I mean, it's Murphy's Law on steroids. And if the people in charge proverbially are in a panic or short and snarky and rude, it trickles down, and it makes what is a beautiful industry and a great, you know, kind of business sometimes not so great for people. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's what I'm really kind of focused on, and making sure that, like, we keep the spirit of great events and great experiences alive. Because at the end of the day, if you look at my capabilities deck, we get to do some really rad, really, really rad shit. And it's kind of, like, ironic that it's work. But it's nice work if you can get it. And we've been really lucky.
So, you know, you've been now coming from nightlife, then going to the agency world. And I want to kind of get to where you are now with your current agency that you've launched. but experiential influencer, this whole world, this whole model is now kind of the last couple of years, I would say, the thing that everybody kind of is those keywords, those trigger words, where brands are going, right?
For sure.
But this is something that you kind of got involved with 5-10 years ago. Very early on, you saw the transition happening. It may not have been called experiential. It may not have been called influencer at that point. But you saw in your mind this transition happening. Did you see it evolving to, A, the place where it currently sits, and B, did you see yourself having an agency that has become kind of one of the leaders in this forefront?
So, a few things to unpack. I mean, this discipline right now is on fire because, and I know and I intuitively understand that I have the wind to my back as a marketer, because we witnessed this period where experiential was emerging, right? And let's go back 15 years ago. And event marketing was a thing, but people's understanding of event marketing was very different. People thought event marketing was sampling and, you know, street teams and you know, maybe a premiere, but it wasn't as nearly as complex as it is now. And then social media happened and MySpace and Facebook and all the tools that event marketers were accustomed to using kind of started to feel a little bit less relevant. And as the business evolved around it and, you know, programmatic advertising started to happen, influencer agencies, you started to see, and I remember losing projects to influencer campaigns and things like this. You started to see this intrigue, you know, or pivot to digital. And as an experiential marketer, you could either adapt or become extinct. A lot of people became extinct. A lot of people said they were adapting but didn't. And I figured it out. I understood the connection between the physical events and the digital experience and how to leverage that. And I actually designed, I don't think I get enough credit for this, people. Give me some credit here. But we designed one of the first UX experiences for consumers to connect their mobile devices using RFID technology through Facebook to a live event with a project that we worked on for Hyundai. And it was groundbreaking. And I sort of established myself, you know, as somebody who could go back and forth and understand the digital landscape, but who was really good at experiential. And I became really well-rounded in that regard. And I truly knew in my heart of hearts that I just needed to stick around long enough in the business for when things came back to experiential. And what ended up happening is there's a superficiality to digital, and brands recognize that from a measurement standpoint. But beyond that, on a visceral level, you need the experience to create the opportunities for content. So without the right experiences and the right platforms, all of the dollars that these brands were spending on digital and influencer and social media was falling short of expectations. So really quickly, the pendulum swung back to experiential. And, you know, at that point, I had spent a few years bouncing around, you know, creative director here, executive director there for these big agencies, and, you know, the 800-pound, you know, momentums of the world. And I was always this behind-the-scenes guy who had this incredible network and didn't really want to be front and center. I didn't need to be the guy. I didn't need to... you know, I don't know if it was a confidence thing or if I just wasn't ready, but I just never felt like I needed to be the main. I always felt comfortable operating in the shadows and knowing that, like, I'm the guy your agency's going to call more than likely to get something done. It's like, we need a party at Art Basel. Well, call Zev. We need to figure out Super Bowl. Well, call Zev. We need something at Coachella. Call Zev. We have to do an event in New York. Call Zev. And that sort of just became, I became really comfortable, you know, in that. And not a bad thing, right? But, you know, when we started Enter, it was a very scary time in my life that I don't really talk about all that much. I had just gone through an exit on a business that I was running with Harris Publications, and we had some media titles, and it was the end of a great run. And at the end of the run, I sort of was left with some questions in terms of where I wanted to go. And I think the one thing I had felt that was missing from my career was this validation from the big agency world. Because I had spent so many years navigating boutique and small agency and just being a behind the scenes guy. You know, I was ready to be, you know, given that imprimatur of, you know, he's a creative director here, or he's a, you know, a executive director there, and see what that looked like. And that was a total disaster for me, because I didn't fit. I didn't belong in that kind of ecosystem. I was never going to, that was never going to work for me. And it was really, it was a great learning experience, but I found myself at a point in my life with, I had a newborn, and a mortgage, and you start to ask some really tough questions. And my wife and I decided to go west, and we moved to LA, and it was sort of start fresh. I had a client at the time, Campari, which meant I had an agency, and that was Enter. And you know, from there it became something. From there, it became something far bigger than me. And I think that's the one thing, especially now in year five or so of Enter, a lot of people that are not close to me think of it as an overnight success story, right? Like, how did you guys get so big so quickly? And I almost resent that, because you wasn't with me shooting in the gym. Like, come on, you know? And I've forgotten more events than most people could ever execute in their life at this point. And, you know, there's a lifetime baked into Enter, and there's a lifetime of mistakes and insights and, you know, things that I've curated and that I've lived that I share with our clients. And when you talk about, you know, coming from a place of confidence, I'm supremely, you know, confident to a point now where we're on, you know, we're just, I feel like we're operating on a different level. And it's sort of like, you know, the Matrix scene where, like, you know, everything's slowing down.
But and this is an agency 20 years in the making when you really break it all down.
No, for sure. No doubt about it. I mean, I can go back to handing out tickets outside of a nightclub in Lido Beach or Long Beach, Long Island, you know, and just working the line on the street and promoting and promoting and always promoting. And I'm still a promoter. I just get to do it for AT&T and Anheuser-Busch and Lululemon, and the stakes have changed, but, like, you know, the game hasn't really for me. And, you know, we built something that's, and I hate to use the term anti-agency in a sense, but we're extremely lean, extremely flat. I mean, that for me was, like, the most important thing. I just wanted teams. I want people to be able to work together and harness that, because I think it's such a simple thing that's so overlooked in corporate organizational charts in terms of how things happen. And, you know, for me, I think we've been incredibly successful in developing teams that work well together and can tackle any project. I mean, we just did a project for, you know, InBev, you know, for Natural Light Seltzer, Natty Light Seltzer, and we, in 2 weeks' time, We literally secured a yacht, landed a helicopter on the yacht with Trevor Wallace, the comedian, and had, you know, 50 of the most beautiful people from Los Angeles join us. It was 2 weeks, and like most agencies wouldn't have been able to figure that out in 2 months. and for me, it was like just another day in the park. You know, it's like we're built for that, and I relish. The harder the project is, the more excited I am about it, because I'm in like a sadistic way. I want my teams to have the experience of working on these crazy, unrealistic things, so that everything else is easy. Because if you did that, then just imagine what like the next thing is. It's just going to be easier. And I kind of use like this, you know, the rubber band, and like how much can I stretch them? And I'm in tune with that. I actually take pride in that. And, you know, I think it gives everyone confidence, and it makes them experts, and it makes them leaders, and it gives them the ability to anticipate and do all those things that I find myself doing. So in a way, it's me passing on a little bit of what I've learned and how I operate, without explicitly saying so.
Yeah.
So that we're just that better equipped for the next thing.
Do you think more people should, you know, your successes, your lessons have been learned by running into the fire versus away from it? If people went and kind of hit things head on, would they be more successful? Would they not fear all these other things and these other outsides? I mean, 2 week time, for instance, let's take this yachting event. Most people would say, oh shit, it can't be done. That's crazy.
Most agencies come from a place of no. You can't do that. You can't afford this. No, it's not possible. I come from a place of yes. I always joke that like our slogan will be, we'll figure it out. I think, again, people are, especially today, people are super critical of themselves. And we, you know, I brings to mind a situation we had, you know, with a gal on our team, and she won, right? Like we had a project and she fucking crushed it and she won. Yet somehow she convinced herself through body language or whatever that we lost. And it was a total win. And she was so sad and her mindset was so off. And I sat her down on Monday and I said, you realize you won, right? Like, you should be celebrating yourself, and you should be like your biggest cheerleader. And it was so poignant to me because everyone's responses and everyone's reactions are so different. And as a leader, I have to be able to interpret that. And I literally had a kid whose work was spectacular, whose execution was perfection and flawless for the most part, and should have been celebrating, yet she was crying at the end of a project. And you know, for me, how did you get there, right? Like, is that a personal thing? Is there something I could have done to be more supportive? It would have been very easy for me to put blinders on and ignore that, but like, I'm not that person, and I needed to tell this person, like, you're a fucking gangster. Like, do you realize what you just did? Like, you should be, you know, far in a far different headspace. And I truly believe I was instrumental in turning her mindset around. And part of me is like, I just want little beast modes all around me. And like, how do you train that? And like, how do you sharpen people to become their own beast mode? And like, I knew that she needed, in that moment, I just knew that she needed a beast mode moment where she could just be like,
I'm the shit.
I fucking did it. And like, you forget that a lot if you keep going really fast and it's like, just go, 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 go. And like, every once in a while, I need to stop myself and say, like, you know, this person needs some different reinforcement.
So, you know, I always look at people's journeys, and it doesn't matter whether they worked at McDonald's as a kid or worked in the nightlife industry, but it's amazing. And I think this is where a lot of younger people get lost, right? They get a job and, well, it's not where I want to be, or it's not who I am or what my goal is. But they don't realize how much that dictates in the success of later on ventures and businesses. It seems like your success at the end of the day has come down to one industry that has shaped us all, which is hospitality. By learning people, starting with baseball cards, personalities, how these people were, to how people were at doors, to how you set up tables, you understood the business of people. And that has simply translated into experiential, where psychology is a huge part of it. Experience and takeaway is a huge part of it. You're feeding people's souls and their experiences. And it seems like you get high, not off of doing cool shit, but doing off of memorable things that people walk away from and are effective in some emotional capacity. All stemming back, though, from your investment into people as, how was your night at the club? How was this? How was that? You're just doing it now for brands versus a nightclub venue. What do you think is next for you, for Enter, and for kind of the growth of this company? Because you forecasted up until this point pretty well. I'm curious where you think it's going to go from here.
Yeah, I mean, my blueprint is pretty clear to me in terms of next steps. Enter was designed to be an incubator first. Like, if you look at any of our, you know, messaging, it's, we're a marketing incubator. Because I've known for quite some time that, again, when you think about the ceilings, right? Like, as a marketer, this is actually an insane parallel. As a marketer, as an agency owner, there's a ceiling, right? And, you know, we're only going to make X per year and profit Y. But we work with these really exciting brands and these startups and these emerging businesses that are, you know, and these entrepreneurs that are just incredible. I have now sort of positioned myself as a venture marketer, where not only are we working with these startups and emerging brands, but we're investing in them, and we're their agency, and we're literally their resource. And, you know, for me, that's absolutely the next chapter of Enter. It's the next chapter of my career, where, you know, we're going to start seeking board seats and things like that, so that I can become an even more impactful driver within these companies that we work with. Again, everyone's so focused on agencies and agency life, and it's like, I'm doing a Series C right now at $120 million raise and helping out one of our clients. Like, that's what I'm excited about, and that's sort of what gets me kind of moving. And, you know, that's a big part of our 2020 and beyond, is how do we become more vertically integrated into our partners. You know, it's amazing to work with AT&T and InBev and Lucky Brand, but I, you know, we work with a company right now called Perfect Day, which is changing the world. I mean, they are ostensibly going to be the, you know, Impossible or Beyond for the dairy industry. That's amazing. Like, that's the type of stuff that, like, for me, after such a long career, like, I'm really gravitating towards and trying to identify more things like that, that have a higher purpose, but also we're vested and we're part of this company now. And for me, that's definitely like the long-term, you know, goal of Enter, and, you know, understanding our role as an incubator. To that end, we've designed a space in Los Angeles called Agency Coffee Company, which is basically a speakeasy clandestine version of an office. We operate out of, you know, a coffee shop on Melrose and Fairfax. That's not really a coffee shop. It's just our office. And, you know, for me, it connects back to my hospitality background, but it's also like my own little personal Soho house. And, you know, we use that space, we invite startups, we share it with brands, we share it with, you know, influencers and people that we think, you know, could use an office space for the day. And it's been incredibly rewarding in that regard, in the sense that we've developed our own version of community that's a direct reflection of my business and Enter as an agency.
I mean, look, if you're going to be out here telling brands that you create experiences and you think of things differently, I think the office space is a pretty good testament to that.
Sometimes confusing because it actually says do not enter on the front door, which I get a kick out of.
Hey, you know, it gets people's attention though.
For sure.
And that's what you're always here for. So, you know, I think you've dropped a lot of jewels, man. And look, there's a lot of people that want to get pop culture, that want to get into agency world, that want to get into nightlife. You've embodied a lot of different industries. What is something that you can kind of, if people were going to take away one thing from this episode, one kind of nugget of just game from you, what would that be?
I'll tell you what I say. I mean, I don't know the... You got me on this one.
And it may not be as simple as a one-liner.
Yeah, I mean, look. Looking backwards, everything that I knew has changed, so it's so hard to draw parallels, right? Like, even the hospitality industry is dramatically different. Like, there's so much change that's happened looking backwards. It's hard to think about how that informs things looking forwards. I honestly don't know how to answer the question. I'm truly speechless.
And for me, I'll tell you, the thing is this, I appreciate when people don't answer it right away. Some people hit it right off because they really have a motto or a thing they kind of live by. Some people actually take a minute because it's really a big loaded question in a lot of ways.
It's super heavy.
But I almost look at it as like, you said things like, be a student, obsessed about what you do. What are some of those things that are actually doable for a person that sits there? If you really want to perfect your craft, Malcolm Gladwell, 10,000 hours, what is that thing that you like would push and like beat the shit out of for somebody to understand?
So there's a book that just came out a couple of months ago. It's this. The author's name is Alex Banyan. I think it's called The Third Door.
Okay.
But the whole philosophy is like path less traveled. And I'm just fucking the guy who took the path less traveled. You know, I there was never a straight line for me. And I think there's something embedded in that notion of like, you have to follow your heart. And I don't want to sound rhetorical here, but, you know, I think there's an instinct that most people ignore. And the ones who can be truly successful and unlock beast mode, I love saying beast mode, by the way. The ones who can unlock it, follow that instinct and trust it. And again, it's really not about being right all the time. And I think so many people are confused by that. It's about the persistence. So there's one thing that I could focus on more than anything, and it's sort of an analog to obsession. It's a persistence. And I am relentless. Actually fucking relentless when it comes to pursuing things that I want. And I'm a savage. Like there's no denying in every aspect of life and business that I am a truly a savage, and I'm literally playing the Diddy video in my head where he throws all the computers and phones off his desk and he's like, just what's next?
Yeah.
And that's, I live every day with that same exact mindset. And, you know, I love Diddy, but it's just like, what's next? Bring me something. What's next? What can I solve? What can I do? How can I help you? And it's just, you have to be a savage. And none of this stuff, it doesn't come naturally to people. And the ones that it does, you win. And like, if it doesn't, like, chances are, you're not. And you know, I like to be surrounded by winners. And I think, you know, it's a quality that I've honed. I was not always this way. I think I knew, you know, I knew bits and pieces of it. But now it's like I've reached.
Put the dots together. Like
I've connected the dots. And I truly feel like I've unlocked the best version of myself. And I hope that the people around me will feel the same way.
Listen, man, I'm excited for people to hear this. I mean, I love the passion. I love to see the growth. And like I said, I love to see a 20-year overnight success.
That's it.
But, you know, for people that want to learn more about Enter, about yourself, kind of where could they find out? Drop. This is where you kind of plug yourself. So there's nothing for Enter.
There's no website, no social media.
I love it.
It's just we're against the grain. You can, I mean, if they're friends with you, and you know, we can make an introduction. But my email is zev, at enter.works. Instagram is at Zev Narotsky, and I promise to respond to each and every one of you guys.
He's from New York. He responds right away.
And if you're ever in LA, your office is my office and my office is your office. So come visit us at Agency Coffee Company on Melrose, and we'll hope to see you there.
Listen, man, appreciate you coming through, and we'll finish this off. If you know, you know. If you know, you know. Appreciate it, Zev.
No doubt.
Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.